Today is Monday, January 28th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington, sitting in for Lori London. Coming up, the latest on the Venezuela political crisis.
He's willing to do whatever it takes to secure the border. He does take this very seriously. This is a serious humanitarian and security crisis, and as President of the United States, he takes the security of the nation as his highest priority.
The U.S. government shutdown is over for now, yet border security still needs to be resolved. And we'll have the latest on the search for survivors after a dam burst in Brazil. It's all on today's International Edition. Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro rejected international demands to call new elections Sunday as the political crisis in his country deepens days after the opposition leader declared himself interim president. The United States Sunday warned there would be a significant response to anyone who threatened or intimidated 35-year-old opposition leader Juan Guaido, or U.S. diplomats. On Saturday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo took his appeal for support for Guaido to the United Nations. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports.
Secretary Pompeo called the Maduro regime an illegitimate mafia state and criticized countries including Russia, China, Iran, and Cuba for supporting him.
And now it's time for every other nation to pick a side. No more delays, no more games. Either you stand with the forces of freedom, or you're in league with Maduro and his mayhem.
Several European governments, including Britain, Spain, Germany, and France, said Saturday that they would recognize 35-year-old opposition leader and head of the democratically elected National Assembly, Juan Guaido, as president if no election is called within 8 days. Guaido declared himself interim president on January 23rd. But powers Russia and China and several left-leaning Latin states have expressed support for Maduro, who was sworn in for a second 6-year term on January 10th, following elections that many voters boycotted and whose results have been challenged both domestically and internationally. Russian envoy Vasily Nebenzia directly asked Secretary Pompeo if the United States plans to use military force in Venezuela. He is heard here through an interpreter.
Does that mean that the United States is ready to use military force against a sovereign state under a bogus pretext? Because it is here in this room that we need to hear a clear answer whether Washington intends to once again violate the UN Charter.
Pompeo offered no response at the meeting and sidestepped a reporter's question about it, saying he would not speculate on what the U.S. would do next. Maduro has accused Washington of instigating a coup d'etat and told U.S. diplomats to leave the country. His foreign minister, Jorge Arreaza, traveled to New York for the Security Council meeting. He told the council that despite Washington's intervention and tweets from Secretary Pompeo and Vice President Mike Pence that he said incited and support the opposition, his government is still willing to talk to Washington. The United Nations has warned that the situation is cause for serious concern and may rapidly spiral out of control with catastrophic consequences. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Among the top stories in the world, the Trump administration has lifted sanctions on Russian firms linked to oligarch Oleg Deripaska, despite a push by the Democrats to keep the sanctions in place. A hotel wall collapsed during a wedding celebration in Peru, killing at least 15 people on Sunday. Pope Francis celebrated a final mass on Sunday before an estimated 700,000 people and presidents from across Central America in Panama. Nigeria is rejecting foreign criticism over the suspension of the country's chief justice. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute. Some of the biggest challenges NASA faces to meet its goal of sending humans to Mars in the 2030s is making sure its astronauts are kept healthy and safe from harm. Unlike current space flights, a round trip to Mars would involve about 3 years of deep space travel. Cosmic and solar radiation and a weakening of muscles and bones are among the health problems NASA has of sending humans into deep space. A recent University of Arizona-led study now expresses concern about the effects such a journey would have on an astronaut's immune system. The researchers studied the effects of spaceflight on NK cells, a type of white blood cells that kills cancer and stops dormant viruses in the body from restarting. They found weakened NK cell functions in astronauts who were up in space 6 months or longer compared to those who hadn't traveled to space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Thank you for joining us for VOA's International Edition. Government workers head back to work Monday after the 35-day partial U.S. government shutdown. Joining me is White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, the longest shutdown in U.S. government history was brought to an end, at least for 3 weeks, on Friday. What prompted President Trump to back down from his demands and sign onto a bill that doesn't include any funding for his wall?
Well, Jim, I think pretty much he was just watching television and saw day by day the impact that the government shutdown was having, and also looking at the polls that showed that more people were blaming him and the Republicans than they were the opposition Democrats.
Well, appearing on CBS's Face the Nation, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney says over the next 3 weeks, the country will see how serious the Democrats are about border security.
What you saw this week was the president take them at their word and say, okay, y'all have said you want to do this, let's give it a shot and see if over the next 3 weeks we can do this the right way and pass legislation to fund the government and secure the border.
What are you hearing about what the final spending bill will look like?
Jim, not much. It really looks like it's going to be difficult to get an agreement first between the Republicans and Democrats, and then something that the president will agree to sign, because it all does hinge on border security. And Donald Trump has been very adamant that he wants money designated for a wall along the border with Mexico, $5.7 billion. Now, Democrats have said they're willing to give even more money for border security, but not money for a wall.
Well, you made a very interesting point there. You said the Democrats and Republicans are negotiating on a bill, but there's no guarantee that Trump will sign it. So is the White House going to be involved in the final negotiations, or are they going to sit back and wait and see what Congress produces?
Well, there's this bipartisan group that's going to work on the nuts and bolts of it. But I think pretty much the Republicans know the parameters of what the president's been insisting on. But we have had some flexibility from the president. But most likely, we're going to have a scenario where there is not a deal. And then one of three things happens. The government shuts down again on February 15th, or Trump declares a border emergency so he can build his wall and the government stays open. Or the government stays open and Trump does not declare an emergency. But if that last scenario there, then he has real problems from his right flank. A lot of them are already accusing him of caving by opening up the government without a border wall deal. And if he essentially does that a second time, that could really be costly to him politically.
Well, he's getting a lot of criticism from both sides of the aisle, from the right, from many of the conservative pundits, and also from Democrats. Are there winners and losers after the month-long shutdown?
Well, I think a lot of people in the country would say there were no winners out of this. But there are some of Trump supporters who say that well, he was able to do this because he has the leverage and he won. But that is a distinctly minority view. And you'll see many more commentators, even some who have been Trump allies, saying that it was Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, who really was the winner out of this, because she stood firm and was the one who did not blink.
Okay, well, let's turn now to the Russian investigation. On Friday, President Trump's close friend Roger Stone was indicted. On ABC's This Week Sunday, he said he's not worried about what FBI agents will find after executing search warrants on his homes in New York and Florida.
No, not in the slightest. I am concerned that they took a number of privileged communications between me and my attorneys. But in all honesty, I have been under surveillance for 2 years. My email, my text messages, my phone calls have been fully reviewed.
How is President Trump reacting to the arrest of Stone?
There have been a number of tweets by the president digging up his old line about the Mueller investigation being a witch hunt. The president, according to lawyers, needs to be very careful what he says in public now. Roger Stone himself is accused of witness tampering, and there have been accusations by former federal prosecutors that some of Trump's tweets about those who have been ensnared in the Russia investigation, that those tweets in themselves are signs of witness tampering. But I can tell you one thing. We have not heard the last from Donald Trump on this, and we also have not heard the last from Roger Stone, who was very defiant after his initial court appearance in Florida on Friday and came out, spoke to the media in front of the courthouse, not something we usually see after somebody's just posted a $250,000 bond to secure their freedom pending trial on very serious federal charges.
Well, Stone is the sixth key figure in Trump's orbit to be accused of criminal offenses as a result of the Mueller investigation. Mr. Trump, as you mentioned, is continually referring to this as a witch hunt. What are you hearing about how Mr. Trump is dealing with this privately?
Well, the reports that we usually hear is that Trump really is quite energetic about it, in the sense that he gets quite temperamental. And I think President Trump, his reactions on these sort of things are very transparent. We see him reacting to television news coverage within minutes on Twitter. Maybe the only difference in private from what I can tell talking to White House aides is his language is a bit more coarse in private than it is on Twitter.
All right. White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure, Jim.
For more on the Russian investigation and the arrest of Roger Stone, I'm joined now by VOA's Masoud Farivar, who has been covering the Russian investigation. What is Stone accused of? The charges are related to the special counsel's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. national election. Joining me is VOA's Masoud Farivar, who has been covering the Russia investigation. Masoud, thank you for being here. What is Stone accused of?
Thank you, Jim. So the charges against him, the seven counts included in the indictment, stem from a testimony that he gave to the House Intelligence Committee back in September of 2017. During the testimony, he was asked about his interactions with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, during the 2016 campaign. And he is accused of making false statements about his interactions with WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. He's also accused of obstructing justice and tampering with a witness. And that involves getting a close associate of his to also lie to Congress about the role that he played in facilitating this interaction with Julian Assange, between Julian Assange and Roger Stone.
Does this have anything to do with the president?
Directly, no. Indirectly, yes. Remember, Roger Stone has been a longtime friend, associate, and advisor of the president. He was not involved with the campaign. He was not an official member of the campaign during the time that the alleged interactions between him and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks took place. But he was working on behalf of the campaign. He was campaigning for the president through a super PAC that he created. And, you know, among other things that helped pay for this famous billboard showing Trump as Superman in Times Square. And he also made a number of media appearances, was active on social media, and actively working for the president's campaign. So what the indictment shows is that he was in close contact with Trump campaign officials. In fact, was asked by a Trump campaign official to find out more about the WikiLeaks plans to release damaging emails about Hillary Clinton and her campaign chairman, John Podesta.
The special counsel's investigation has been methodical with indictments, and they've been seemingly getting closer and closer to Mr. Trump's inner circle. Do we have reason to believe there will be more indictments?
I think there are indications that there will be more indictments. Roger Stone's indictment was, of course, you know, widely expected. He had hinted and said in recent weeks that he would be indicted. A couple of other people who have also suggested that they would be indicted are Jerome Corsi and another Roger Stone associate, who also played a role in the whole WikiLeaks episode. And finally, the president's eldest son, Don Jr., has said that he also expects to be indicted. We don't know who else will be indicted, but all expectations are that we will likely see some indictments in the coming weeks.
Okay. We've been watching this play out for almost 2 years. Where do things go from here?
Well, you know, additional indictments probably, but there's also an expectation that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has probably hit the home stretch and is working on a final report. We don't know what kind of a final report it will be. It will be when it's prepared, it will be given to the Attorney General, and a version of that report will be probably shared with Congress. But in the meantime, it appears that the special counsel is still busy seeking testimony, statements, and probably working on additional indictments.
That's VOA's Masoud Farivar, and this is VOA's International Edition. Twin bombings Sunday at a cathedral in the restive southern Philippines have killed 20 people and wounded 81. Late Sunday, the Islamic State terrorist group claimed responsibility for the blasts. AP's Karen Chamis reports.
Troops in armored carriers sealed off the main road leading to the church, while vehicles transported the dead and wounded to the town hospital, as a crowd appeared behind the cordons. Witnesses said the first blast inside the Jolo Cathedral in the provincial capital sent churchgoers, some of them wounded, to stampede out of the main door. Army troops and police posted outside were rushing in when the second bomb went off about 1 minute later near the main entrance, causing more deaths and injuries. The military has been investigating a report that the second explosive device could have come from a parked motorcycle next to the church. I'm Karen Chamas.
The death toll from Friday's dam collapse in southeastern Brazil rose to 58 Sunday, a number that's expected to climb with more than 200 people feared buried under tons of mud. Reuters' Pasquale Davis has more on the search for survivors.
The search for the hundreds missing after a dam collapsed in Brazil has resumed. 24,000 people were evacuated on Sunday after a second dam in the same community risked giving way. However, that warning was later called off. On Friday, a dam at an iron mine collapsed, devastating the mine itself and a local town. Scores of people have been killed and hundreds more are feared dead. The dam's rupture on Friday released a torrent of mining waste that cut through a nearby community, leaving an 150-meter-wide trail of destruction.
I saw a noise up there. I wondered what it was. It was like a strong rain slamming down. When I came down, I saw that there was a mountain of trees, water crashing down, trees toppling over. It was then that I saw it was the dam.
This is not the first major disaster linked to the miner's owner, a corporation called Vale SA. 3 years ago, Brazil suffered the worst environmental catastrophe in its history when another dam burst at a mining project that Vale was partnered in and poured toxic waste into a river. 19 people were killed in that incident. But Friday's dam collapse has proved deadlier than that.
That's Reuters' Pasquale Davis reporting. And this is VOA's International Edition.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel for Lori London. This year's World Economic Forum Summit in Davos, Switzerland, had some notable absentees, including U.S. President Donald Trump. With backlash against a perceived ruling elite gaining ground in many countries, some leaders are steering clear of a gathering, often seen as an inaccessible club for the world's super rich. But others say it is vital they get together to discuss urgent issues like climate change. Henry Ridgewell reports.
On the surface, it's business as usual at Davos. On a sealed-off, snowbound mountaintop, world leaders rub shoulders with global executives, lobbyists, and pressure groups. A vital gathering of global decision-makers, says Leslie Vinjamuri of policy group Chatham House.
They're there to do business. They're there to engage in an exchange of ideas. And so I think it's still tremendously important.
But this year, there's no American delegation. President Trump has stayed away amid the U.S. government shutdown. China's President Xi Jinping isn't here. Neither is Britain's Theresa May, nor France's President Emmanuel Macron.
They're tremendously preoccupied with the troubles that they face at home, which isn't a good sign for globalism. The criticism and the critique that surrounds Davos is extraordinary. People say, you know, it's where all those people go to sort of have dinner with each other. Has nothing to do with the rest of us. And of course, it's about a lot more than that, but the optics are tremendously negative at this point in time.
While Davos is sealed off by high security, delegates are well aware of a growing global backlash. David Gergen of the Harvard Kennedy School echoed the concerns of many at Davos during one debate this week.
We've had some good economic times. Incomes have gone up in a number of countries, and yet the discontent is deep. And is threatening our democracies.
The absence of many big players means others have stolen the limelight. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed Ali has been widely praised for making peace with Eritrea. He said African countries must deepen their ties.
We believe integration must be viewed not just as an economic project, but also as crucial to securing peace and reconciliation in the Horn of Africa.
Other issues, too, have risen up the Davos agenda, notably climate change. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern urged action.
This is about being on the right side of history. And do you want to be a leader that you look back in time and say that you were on the wrong side of the argument when the world was crying out for a solution?
Yeah.
And it's as simple as that, I think.
But Davos 2019 will likely be remembered for the lack of global leadership, says analyst Vinjamuri.
That space has been vacated. Nobody necessarily even wants to take things forward at the level of providing a vision and a set of tangible policy proposals for how to actually implement a vision that can carry us through a really troubling time.
The lack of such a vision at a time of profound global change has sent a chill far beyond the confines of this winter resort. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Thank you, Henry. It was a quiet weekend at North American movie theaters, with little change at the top and a couple of new flops. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
I specialize in those individuals who believe they are superheroes.
M. Night Shyamalan's Glass is number one at the box office for a second weekend, earning an estimated $19 million in ticket sales.
Good for you.
It's again followed by The Upside and Aquaman as two newcomers struggle to attract an audience.
Now, you must choose.
The updated King Arthur tale, The Kid Who Would Be King, debuted at number four with just $7.3 million.
I want you to drop him in the ocean for the sharks.
While Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey's Serenity could only muster eight, with a mere $4.8 million.
Sometimes we do bad things for good reasons.
I'm Ben Thomas.
And this is VOA's International Edition. The NFL's best football players squared off Sunday in the annual Pro Bowl game in Orlando, Florida. AP's Kyle Cassandra reports the AFC won the game for the third straight year.
It was a wet and wild 2019 NFL Pro Bowl where Team AFC defeated Team NFC 26-7 at Camping World Stadium in Orlando. Fans were treated to performances by Patrick Mahomes, Andrew Luck, Russell Wilson, Dak Prescott, Ezekiel Elliott, and Saquon Barkley, to name a few. Despite the score, it was all fun and games in both locker rooms after the game. Now the football world heads to Atlanta for Super Bowl 53. Kyle Cassandra, Orlando.
From Orlando, we move up the East Coast to New York City, where a New York disc jockey wearing a policeman's uniform is making headlines for himself. The outfit he's wearing is not a costume. It's the work uniform of a New York City police officer who takes his hobby as a DJ seriously. Lieutenant Aku Rhodes says it started as a casual pastime, but quickly became a serious devotion. So serious that Rhodes, or DJ Ace, turned it into part of the NYPD's community policing outreach. VOA's Anna Rice has the story.
A DJ mixer and a New York City police uniform. NYPD Lieutenant Aku Rhodes, or DJ Ace, can be seen behind the turntable in his free time. His love for music began when he was five.
My mom had a compact stereo, and on this stereo, the turntable was at the very top, and she had it on the shelf. So I would have to stand on my toes and manipulate the record and try to imitate the hip-hop records that I was listening to on the radio.
His love for music continued through his 5 years in the Navy and 2 decades as a police officer. It evolved beyond that after he took part in a Cops and Kids DJ battle, part of the NYPD's community policing outreach.
It was an event where the cops couldn't really win the battle, but they would get a chance to showcase their skills. The video from that event went viral, and I got a lot of notoriety. So since then, I've been doing a lot of community events in uniform, DJing also.
So now Lieutenant Rhodes transforms into DJ Ace at least twice a month, performing at malls, sporting events, and on street corners.
I think he's great. I just came here to buy socks. And I got a show, man.
It's great. It's all about community.
He said it's kind of a fun stunt, but, you know, it's cool. I like it.
NYPD's community outreach program is among the department's highest priorities. It helps police connect with younger people in a unique way.
Some people don't think I'm a real police officer, and people are very comfortable approaching me after seeing me DJ in uniform. They're very comfortable talking to me, asking me different questions, and, you know, I get a chance to tell them that it's just not me, you know, that's a decent person. It's, you know, I say 99.9% of the police force, you know, they're like me, regular folks.
Lieutenant Rhodes says his DJ work has helped him deal with stressful parts of his job, like when he faced an armed suspect.
The individual actually recognized me from the neighborhood. He became very calm. I asked him to put the knife down. He immediately put the knife down, and we built up a rapport. We got the individual some help, took him to the hospital. He actually moved out of the shelter that he was staying in. He actually got married, and he lives in Queens right now.
Rhodes has an Instagram account where he publishes his tracks. Among his online friends are fellow police officers and others who share his passion for music, music celebrities in New York and around the world. For Evgeny Maslov in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. I want to thank our studio team, Director Tracy Carter, also engineer Jimmy Cook, and I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.